laying into the movies. Hey girl, plug in those headphones. It's late to the movies.
Anyway, I'll start recording now. Fuck.
Fuck.
Oh no.
Fuck.
Okay, it's been so long since that happened. You can tell I haven't done in person in a while.
Yep.
Here's the actual intro to the episode then. I had a scare a few days ago before the last episode came out because Craig broke.
You scared me.
Craig was dead. They had to kill Craig. That's literally a line that a maintenance person put in the Craig Discord. We had to kill Craig. And I thought of like an old Yeller situation. Craig is just like, he's a danger to himself at this point. He's gone rabid or something. Craig is the anthropomorphized bear iconed bot that lives in the Discord server and records our Discord episodes. All to say, my mind has been very focused on Craig and Discord, and he pulled through. And, you know, if you follow the podcast, you see last week the episode came out at the right time. It just, I couldn't edit it until much later than I wanted to. So I'm not used to recording in person. Vaz and I have had a great 20-ish minute conversation so far, and I recorded 0% of it.
But we all remembered it. We did write it down as well. So we're just going to say verbatim. Are we not recording now?
No, we're recording now. I'm sorry, and I'm sad.
Yeah, I know. That's how it is.
And more...
You know what? It's going to be better this time. This time will be better.
Normally, I'm joking when I say this, but as you know, I don't know how to start the podcast. So it'll either be 20 minutes of us talking to ourselves, and then I hit the red button. And it's even literally a red button that lights up. You'd think. Anyway. Or something along the lines of Welcome to Late at the Movies. Again, this is a podcast. No, my name. My name's Ben Holland. This is a podcast where my friends and I get to fill in our movie blind spots. Each week, we'll pick a film that either I or a guest hadn't seen before and really should have just gone home by now. Not as funny that you've heard it in person 20 minutes ago.
You made it work, though.
Thank you. I appreciate that. The listeners haven't. This is only painful for us. Well, that's not true, probably. But anyway, guest left, right across the podcast now. We got Vaz.
What do you want from me, Ben? What am I doing here? I'm just a word processor. I messed up the line, too.
I mean, it works, though. It's just like, you thought we were on our way and you just can't go home. You can't do what you want to do.
Everything you touch gets destroyed.
You just want to do something that's simple that you've done a million times, and it just isn't happening. You're stuck in some sort of nightmare, and you just can't get out of Soho.
I can't get my keys. Where are my keys?
It's fucked up. Yeah, everything you touch is evil and hurts you. Anyway, as my $20 bills fly out the window of this taxi that's going way too fast, let's do the short version of this. What have you seen recently? We were talking about Alex Garland's Civil War.
Yeah, I remember. I think we briefly mentioned it and talked about it.
I'm not even going to do the I like when life gives me Plemons thing anymore. We did a whole thing on Stephen McKinley Henderson.
And it was pretty good.
Kristen does good in that movie, too.
Yep. Kirsten and
Kiki.
The other guy, Plemons, they're married.
Yeah.
We both like the movie.
We both like the movie a lot.
It's not really about a civil war. It's more about photojournalism. But it's great. Looks great.
A few months ago, I felt like the world was trying to make me... feel like Jacob Elordi meant a lot to me.
Who's Jacob Elordi?
He's new Elvis in Priscilla.
From Elvis or Priscilla. Yeah.
He's new Elvis.
Tall Elvis.
And a bunch of other things. Euphoria.
Salty Burns.
And I guess on the Priscilla set, he handed the baton to Kaylee Spaney because now she's in every movie. Priscilla, this... I pointed that not she's not in After Hours. She wasn't born until 20 years after After Hours.
But her spirit's in there.
the movie this week is After Hours by Martin Scorsese. It's one night only month. Fucking whatever.
They know.
You clicked on it. You read. Just read.
Podcasts do this every time. They're like, hey, here's the people on the show. Like, no, we know. We're not going into this blind.
And she stars in Alien Romulus out this summer, the new Alien movie. Kaylee Spaney is also in
it. Oh, is she the Alien or the Romulus?
I think she's playing Romulus in that one.
Good for her. That's a title. That's the titular role of Romulus.
Yeah, exactly. It's the titular role. Anyway, she's also good in Civil War. Everyone's good in it. Alex Garland's direction is good in it too.
Yeah, I really like him. I hope he does more movies.
Turns out he's not gonna direct anymore, but he does want to keep writing. And he's like, I'm going to, for this foreseeable future, not direct anymore. And then people were like, oh, so you're not going to be a filmmaker anymore. And he's like, that's stupid. Shut up. I do a lot of other things around movies. I'm like, okay.
Whatever, Alex.
Sure. Seems like a weird guy.
He does.
Seems like a guy who, the point we made before was, I'm not sure how much he actually cares about the sort of stuff that gets included in his movies. But I think they all look really interesting. And three of them I at least like a lot. Two of them I think are excellent. And I thought Civil War was probably a step below Ex Machina and Annihilation, but a step above most other movies.
Yeah, especially this year.
Yeah, especially this year. There hasn't been a ton of big stuff. It's really this and Dune 2.
Yeah.
I liked Love Lies Bleeding a lot.
Same. I liked Lisa Frankenstein a lot.
I haven't seen it yet.
It's actually great. Really. Yeah, Brie really liked it. I know she brought up last ep. She was on.
Monkey Man's on streaming pretty soon.
I was a little disappointed by Monkey Man.
Right.
Yeah. Still check it out.
There was just a human man the whole time.
Yeah, it's most. It's largely human man.
Ugh.
I know.
Come on, Dev.
I already read him a letter.
Speaking of devs, Alex Garland, though, good filmmaker.
Yeah, I like devs.
Heyo.
Although that ran into the thing of like, oh man, I'm going to talk about like, life and like what's the meaning and then like oh I have to come up with an ending whatever like nice try Alex.
I haven't watched Ex Machina in a while, but I saw the point made earlier on I'll come clean on Reddit that at least his last three movies and maybe all four of the movies he's directed all have largely dialogue-less final 15-ish minutes. So that's interesting. I don't know what that means, but it's pretty cool. And like you're not bored. They're all like interesting. Have you seen Annihilation? I only saw it for the first time this week.
It's been too long for me.
Movie, so that might have been when you say.
I think it was pre-pandemic for me. So it's a lot of it's a blur, or like I can't remember it.
Yeah,
I do want to rewatch it again.
I think I mentioned on a recent pod. I read the book Annihilation, which I know Alex Garland's. Purposely didn't use as a reference when he was writing the screenplay for the movie, and that it's only basically kind of just inspired by some of the ideas in. Both really good, very separate, I think ultimately complementary, not clashing, which is an interesting thing to pull off.
I like that.
Yeah.
Last thing I want to say about Civil War and I guess Alex Garland in general. Civil War, very easy to watch. Like just flies by.
Oh god, yeah.
Pacing's great. Yeah. Just some really great filmmaking.
I think it's around 100 minutes, which, as I've said, anytime John Carpenter comes up, is the perfect amount of time for a movie to last. So
yeah,
was happy to see that. Anyway, other movies I watched on that day, I watched Annihilation, and then went to see Civil War. And then Annihilation, by the way, is free on one of the free services, not Tubi. I think Pluto
Crackle?
TV.
Oh, Pluto. TV, oh, right, yep.
Which I think is Canadian or something.
I never tried to use Pluto before, but it's there.
So yeah, all to say, I like Civil War, worth seeing. After watching Civil War in theaters, I came back here and was like, it's a movie day, because maybe it was cold and raining again, I don't know. And then I wanted to see The First Omen in theaters, which I know fucking bombed in its first week. So I'm not sure if it's even still in theaters.
It's still there. Not going to get many screens for it.
But it got pretty good reviews. Like
I was kind of meh about it, actually.
Okay.
The direction in that is really good, though.
Okay.
Yeah. That was my favorite part.
So in order, but I'd never seen the first The Omen. So I wanted to watch the first The Omen before watching The First Omen. Not a confusingly titled movie at all.
You wanted to watch the very first Omen.
Yeah.
Not The First Omen.
Right. Yes. I wanted to watch The First Omen before The First Omen.
Yes.
I'm being needlessly obtuse, but I feel like this is the kind of bit both of us appreciate.
No, I like it.
So I watched for the first time the original Omen from 1976, I think. Richard Donner's breakthrough, and then I think Superman's 78, like 2 years later.
Yeah.
And then that's like a super breakthrough.
And then he makes another super.
And some years later, he makes Goonies.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I hadn't seen the original Omen before. I liked it a lot. I thought it was really good. Has some great kills, which I've seen before. It only has, I think, 5, maybe 6 deaths in the movie. And at least, I mean, 2 of them are classic all-timers that I've seen before, just pulled out as like in some kind of clip reel, best, you know, whether it was AFI's 100 Years, 100 Scares or whatever it is.
For a movie I haven't seen, I'm pretty sure I know the exact death you're talking about. Does it involve a hanging? And yep. All right. Yep. That's the one I know.
Yes. That's a big one. And I was thinking about like, man, how strong 70s horror is. Thinking about a lot of the movies that have come out this year that have gotten pretty good audience response and like above average ratings are like, there's actually been a ton of horror in 2024.
Imagination, Swimming Pool.
Yeah. Well, those are the 2 Blumhouses you got. They're still coasted off of 5 Nights at Freddy's. They'll be fine.
Yep. There's more, but I've seen them. Abigail, that just came out. I just saw that.
Yeah. Oh, you saw Abigail?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was it good?
It's good.
Immaculate was this year.
Sydney Sweeney, yeah.
Late Night with the Devil.
Oh, that's the one I haven't seen, and I really want to. I know you saw it.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. On the last episode, which was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, I referenced the, I think it's Danish. It's a couple from the Netherlands and a couple from Denmark.
No Evil.
Yeah, Speak No Evil.
Speak No Evil.
Kane. I didn't realize when I said that on the episode that just came out on Monday that the trailer for the English language remake of that also came out this week.
Oh, really? I didn't know that they were even doing that.
No, that movie's only like, I don't know, 20 months old. But yeah, there's an English language. I think James McAvoy's starring in it or something. It's like a named dude.
With Mackenzie Davis and Scoot McCurry.
Is it? They're getting the Hall and Catch Fire team back together?
Yeah.
Nice.
I saw the trailer before Abigail.
Nice. Well, I didn't realize that trailer was out when I said that. And then later in the week, I was like, what's happening? And then also, I don't think I had fully wrapped my head around that is coming. And the original movie is really good, and it's not like it's old, and it's out now.
I mean,
it is viewable. So weird. I don't know. It's been on streaming only for like a year.
Are they still doing they want to do an American remake of Another Round with Leonardo DiCaprio?
God, yeah. Fuck off.
Yeah.
Leave Denmark alone.
No.
God.
We want to take all of their movies.
Let's talk about After Hours.
Oh, yeah. The movie.
Dangerously close to going into the After Hours ourselves. We're probably 40 minutes into talking about this podcast.
Hey, you know what? Let's just say it's after hours.
Yeah, it's different rules. It's like an after hours.
Huh.
I watched a short interview where Fran Lebowitz is interviewing Marty.
We both
about
watched
it.
The same interview.
Nice. And I like that he's like, yeah, this was a character actor and he gets to say the title. And then they show that clip.
Dick Miller,
yeah.
Also a great name.
Dick Miller. It's one night only month. Movies that only take place in one night.
Take place in almost, there's a morning and there's some day before.
There's
but it's largely a night movie.
It's a night movie.
Yeah.
It's an endless odyssey-like situation.
And those are like prologue, epilogue anyway.
the escaping that he wants to do makes this feel a lot like Escape from New York, another movie we've done this month.
Yep. He wants to go home. Wizard of Oz, another movie you haven't done this month.
Yeah.
You want to go over the list of ones you haven't done this month?
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
We have done Escape from New York this month.
We did do that one, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you did.
I did, yeah. Much like Snake, Paul just wants to live.
Just want to live.
I had not seen this movie before. I know a lot about it by reputation, by it being a Scorsese movie, this being only our second one, I think, after The Departed, unless I'm forgetting a big one. But yeah, you not in the same boat though, right?
No, I think in 2022, I watched it for the first time, was on Max, and I enjoyed it. And then it came back on Max in 2023, and I was like, I should rewatch this again. It's a Scorsese movie, and I enjoyed it the first time, but I wasn't like crazy about it, but everyone seems like they loved it. And I watched it again, and I was like, no, I still like it, but I'm not crazy about it. And this time, this was the one that clicked. I really liked it.
I'm glad.
I am a big fan of this movie. I have now seen it 3 years in a row, and I kind of feel like watching it, honestly, again now. Or maybe just next year, just making an annual watch.
Yeah. Despite being a dark comedy, I think it's a more effective horror movie than Shutter Island, just from the Scorsese scale.
I agree with you.
I liked it a lot. Before we get into a full analysis beyond that, either of us could do a one-minute plot summary.
Would you like to do it, or would you like me?
I can do it.
I got something in the chamber, but it's
if it's not crazy. If the chamber is full, for it.
I mean, I was going to shoot my load at home if if you weren't going to let me do it here.
What kind of friend would I be? Go ahead and
all right.
shoot away.
All right. So, Paul Hackett. He's a word processor. He met this girl at a cafe, and he got her number, and she went to go see her. And he is essentially punished for wanting to have sex. He's hunted, emasculated, threatened, just the whole gambit. And he just wants to get home. He is desperate
persecuted.
To get home. Yep. And he just goes through a wild ride through Soho, and eventually he makes it back to work.
Yeah. Yeah. And he just starts the day over again.
Yep.
So now that everyone's made it through the preamble, I can say I loved this movie. I thought it was
great.
It's a good time. I was very much on its vibe. One of the things that Fran Lebowitz and Marty Scorsese talk about in that interview, available for free on YouTube.
Yes. It's 20 minutes. It's a fairly easy watch, and they have a great rapport. Repertoire?
Yeah, both.
Or rapport. Good.
Both. They both, and then in their live show, they have a great repertoire.
It seems like they're friends.
Yeah, it almost does. But you can tell they hate each other.
Yes. There's an underlying loathe.
Exactly. And they mentioned that some people are like, why doesn't he just, if he just started walking home, he'd be there by now. And they say, you're not playing the game.
Yep.
You're not in it. You're on the outside.
Yeah. Which when they said that, I was like, that just makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Like I would be doing the same thing. Right. Like I can't walk home. I'm determined to do not that.
Yeah. And I think the first time that he has left Marcy and Kiki's apartment, and then I guess at this point, it's just Kiki's. Marcy doesn't live there, but it's owned by Franklin, her husband, but not her boyfriend, Tom, who she was living with.
And she still sleeps there, though.
She still sleeps there.
It seems like she has a room, though not much.
Yeah. I think she used to live there and she just hasn't been replaced by Kiki, maybe. I don't know. Or maybe she lives there when when Franklin is in town. I'm guessing. I don't know. Whatever. They don't get into it that much.
No.
They don't explain the why of a lot of things happening.
And I love that.
Yeah. And I definitely the first time he ends up back there after leaving, it's like, what the fuck? Just go home. But then when it happens for the third time, you're like, okay.
Now it makes sense.
Yeah, I got you.
He's stuck.
He can't get out of this like four square blocks.
No.
He just can't.
He's stuck going to a bar, to the loft, and then to a woman's house that he hates.
Yep. To a hardcore club.
Oh, yep. The Berlin.
Then back again later when it's a very different vibe.
And then he vents to this one guy's house for like, I don't know, 5 minutes.
A guy who just wanted to have a little gay sex for the first time.
Yep.
And is really disappointed with the experience.
Yep. And he just says, why don't you just go home? And I think
like, I'd love to, but I all these this 10 minutes worth of exposition happened to me. Anyway. Cool movie. So, yeah.
Yeah. One thing I was thinking about when I was watching this, and even before I was watching this, this is not like, I mean, I do rank this decently high on like Scorsese's movies. But this is probably not like a movie that he would have normally have done. And I was thinking of Tarantino and how he only wants to do like 10 movies. And he wants to be like, this is my oeuvre, my solid oeuvre.
Also relevant because he just announced he's canned the movie that he's been working on for a couple years. Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
I'm okay with that. Cause
he specifically, or at least the reporting, I don't know if he was quoted in it, but the reporting is that he decided he doesn't want that to be his last movie. And it's like, dude, just make more then.
Yeah.
It like, seemed no like he was pretty far into this one.
Yeah. And I think he wants to stop making movies, and Scorsese's still making movies, arguably some of his best work.
Yeah.
But like if he was just like focusing on his oeuvre and being like super pretentious, like I don't we wouldn't have gotten this.
No.
We wouldn't have gotten Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore or The Color of Money. And yeah. I don't want to live in that world.
Yeah, he's definitely not guided by a tight lid on what a Scorsese movie is, which is funny because I'd say more than like the blockbuster directors or more than like Tarantino, guys like this, the popular image of Scorsese is, oh, he makes gangster movies.
Yeah.
But it's like, he doesn't.
He makes so many more. He makes so much more. Like he made like maybe 5 gangster movies.
And sure, his most recent epic, other people's magnum opus, maybe not even close to his top 3 or 4 or 5 movies, Killers of the Flower Moon. Sure, Robert De Niro's playing the boss of an organized crime operation, but it's not a gangster movie.
Yeah, it just has gangster elements.
Exactly. After Hours, though.
Yeah, and this one has a mob. This is a mob.
There's a mob in a literal sense.
Yes.
There's an angry mob. I was expecting less of the surrealism, I think. I know that it's like a bad night that keeps getting worse, but it keeps getting worse in both funnier and darker ways than I was expecting. So I really jived with it.
And I don't know about you or how other people would take it, but like someone commits suicide in this movie and it's not that sad, though Paul reacts to it genuinely, but it's
for a bit.
It is just kind of funny.
It's really weird. I don't know how the movie pulled it off because he does have a genuine reaction in that movie in that moment.
Yes.
But I think it's because the joke becomes that he's made it about himself very quickly.
Yep.
And he puts up the dead person arrow signs around the loft.
Because he can't stick around the loft for the paramedics to come pick up the body. He needs to leave because he wants to go home. So he just like, I'm just going to leave the door open with like a comb or whatever.
Yes.
While there's a burgers.
He knows there's robberies going on.
Yep.
Despite protesting later. Oh, I didn't know that. Like he's told that is a situation by John Hurd. It's just all good shit. And like I said, I don't know how the movie pulls that off. So we should say it's constructed as a series of events that happens to this guy who goes out, like he said, looking for some sex because he met a nice kind of quirky girl who's very pretty and goes to her apartment and it gets fucking weird.
And he was just kind of bored at home because he's just some word processor who does some job. He has a kind of drab apartment.
You get the impression that he doesn't usually stay out this late. He doesn't usually hang out with artists in this part of town. He just doesn't belong. Even though everyone to him is strange, the one of the things that they talk about in that interview too, I don't want to pretend this is original thought when it's not, Paul's the one that is strange, right? Because he doesn't belong here. This is just what happens in these places at this time of night. And it's his fault for being there if he doesn't want to be part of it.
Yeah, and it's driving him crazy.
Yes, absolutely. It's just so funny.
It is. And even like at the beginning when he's just when he's at the cafe and he's reading his book and like there's that one weird guy dancing at the counter. Like that's kind of funny. And like, it just gets like, I love the car ride, the taxi ride. And then when he meets the taxi driver again, he just gets shit on by that guy.
Yeah. The guy takes all his money.
Yep.
Which is probably fair.
And then I think he yells out like, yeah, I'll be back soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Just way right there. And that's when he meets Catherine O'Hara, one of a series of extremely funny women that populate this movie.
Yep. Who terrorized Paul.
Yeah. So this is, so the main one, I guess main one, Rosanna Arquette.
Yeah.
Is great. It's that one's Rosanna, right?
Yeah. Main one's Rosanna.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Then it's Terry. Then it's Catherine.
Yes.
And then,
I meant more in terms of Arquette. Oh. So that one's Rosanna.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Not Patricia, not David.
Yes.
Okay. Gotcha.
Rosanna Arquette, who I feel like she just dropped off. I don't know.
A little bit.
Yeah.
She's great in this.
Yeah, I loved her in this. I loved everyone in this, I should say that.
Yeah, Linda Fiorentino also.
As a Kiki.
Kiki. Who's kind of just, who ends up being sort of like the nicest of these women to Paul?
Yeah.
Like, well, Terry Garr, I guess. I don't know.
Terry Garr does unintentionally sick a mob after him.
She eventually turns on him. That's true.
Yeah.
I'm more meant in terms not of niceness, but just in like, she's just sort of chill around Paul and no one else is chill around Paul.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Not a single person. But the cast is pretty awesome. It's incredible. It's a lot of people who are so good. And if Paul, again, he is like a main character thing when he, you know, he's breaking down, he's on his knees before he intrudes on that guy's personal space for way too long.
Yep.
And it kind of has almost a Scott Pilgrim-y vibe where the main character doesn't realize that they're kind of an asshole. And as normal, as well-adjusted, as like not weird like these people are weird, as Paul probably is thinking to himself he is the whole time. If he just had been a little less of an asshole a few times, he probably would have gotten home.
Yeah. I mean, and like he does, he's the kind of asshole who's like, he's trying to be nice and he's like, oh yeah, sure, I'll do that. Or, but then he just doesn't, or he'll say like, I'll come back and like, he doesn't.
Right.
Or he'll complain about the pot he got, just because he thinks that she might have, burns.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's really, I don't know how to explain it. The mood created by that whole sequence of Linda Fiorentino, Kiki, and then the books and the pills that he's finding, all sort of implying that she has like some kind of horrible burn scars, and just the mood that's creating. And then you later find out that that's not the case.
It was just for a tattoo. And she just has books about burns for whatever reason. It could be Francis's books. He could be a doctor. Who knows?
And as the night goes on, there's more and more misdirects and coincidences. And I laughed so hard when Terry Garr offered him the bagel and cream cheese paperweight.
That's a great scene. And I love when he's leaving her apartment and she like peeks out the door and is like, hey, you forgot this. And he like shoves it out of her hand. And he's like, what are you doing? Yeah. I don't want this.
Yeah. Poor Terry Garr.
Poor Terry Garr. She did all right. She quit her job.
Yeah.
Also, I like that she talks about the Xerox, that she also works at the Xerox store underneath her. And that's how she has so many copies of this drawing that she did of Paul.
Immediately.
Yep.
Even though it's like 2 a.m., she goes and makes copies.
It's Soho, man.
It's Soho, yeah. Oh, it's just good shit. I like everything. I like his weird times with June, the older-ish woman.
Yep. Oh, I really like those at the near the end of the movie.
Yeah, who covers him in paper mache.
And he plays, so he meets June at like the Berlin Club, which the first time we see it is filled with people, and it's just like this crazy, like everything's going on club. You can barely hear. It's Mohawk Night.
Martin Scorsese is
a light man
dressed like a Nazi.
Something.
Yeah.
And then when he comes back, because it's just empty, and it's just one person there. I mean, two people there: the bartender,
yeah,
and one
an extremely
lady.
Chill bartender, yep. And a lady that's always there, but no one notices.
And the reason no one's there because it's invite only.
Yeah. No one came out tonight.
He has the one quarter that he was left from the bouncer.
Yeah.
I like that the bouncer took his money too.
Yeah. So you know you left nothing untried, or yes. However he puts it.
Yes.
I will take your money, so you know you left no options untried, but you can keep this quarter.
And I know I saw some video of where they said like it almost as though the guy knew like he was going to need that quarter later for whatever reason.
There's a lot of like quasi magic coincidences or stuff that you can infer that level of meaning from, and that's really cool.
Yes.
With so much of the talk, if you look up around it, is the nightmarish or at least dreamlike kind of meandering quality, the wibbly wobbliness of time and reality as all of this stuff is happening, is leading me to fight the urge to you know, be like, so in a David Lynch movie. But we don't have to talk about Lynch.
Yeah. You did bring up time, and I wanted to bring up the score of this movie, which was composed by the guy who did Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
And I just love the score in this movie.
Like, it's really good.
It is. It's 80s, and it kind of has like this almost synth to it, but it also has like a ticking clock noise, yep, with it, and it just rules, and it really rules, yeah, builds up the tension.
I dug it so much.
Same.
It's so good. And yeah, there's a couple times that I normally, something that I'm like always kind of mad at myself for is I like never pick up on a score and how it's making me feel. I guess the good way to spin that is like, oh, I'm just so in it.
Yes.
and not like inattentive, which is the way I would criticize myself for it.
Which a lot of good scores are one that doesn't overshadow the movie. You're
watching. Yeah. And there was a few times in this movie where I was thinking the music is really contributing, yes, to the correct mood here. And that's not normally, it's such a, you know, a 101 level thought, but it is not one I usually have. So definitely stood out to me. Howard Shore. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. I could not remember his name.
No worries.
I also, there's two jokes I really love in this movie. Actually there's a few, but two ones that I want to point out. When Paul goes back to Marcy's and Kiki's apartment for like, I think the third time, and Kiki's tied up. He's trying to untie her, and he's like, who are these guys? Sailors?
It must have taken them hours. So thorough.
That was great. And then when he goes to the diner and it just wants to use the bathroom to wash his face and then look in the mirror and then leave.
One of the many repeated images.
Yes. And he the guy's like, hey, you can't just use the shower. I mean, you can't just use the bathroom and then leave. You have to order something. And he orders a burger and coffee. And then like a half hour later, he returns back to the cafe and he's talking to John Hurt. Is that his name?
John Hurd.
John Hurd.
Yep.
And
the dad from Home Alone.
Yep. And the chef there just gives him the burger he ordered a half hour ago and the coffee. And I think that's just hilarious.
It's good. And that's as the mob is massing outside after yep. John Hurd says he's going to go get his keys.
And he's not. Yeah, no, he stopped by the mob and he's like, oh, no, he's over there.
It's just good stuff. This, even though there's so much interesting things going on, the issue that always comes up when we do a comedy is sort of returning to me is it's hard not to just be like, and then this part was funny.
Yep.
But there are wanted at least go.
Yeah. And I wanted to at least get those out of the way. Cause those are some jokes that I really liked in that movie.
Yeah. Agreed on both counts. Speaking of comedies, have you seen Oh Hello Live or Oh Hello on Broadway?
I have not. I've been meaning to, cause I know it's on Netflix. But I just, I'm bad when it comes to like watching like comedy specials or that kind of stuff on there. Cause I'm like, oh, it's there. I know it's an hour long, so I can just watch it whenever. And then I just never watch it whenever.
There's a great bit in there where it's a joke that builds throughout that George Sankey, which is John Mulaney's character, refers to Gil Faison, Nick Kroll's character, as the strongest actor in New York. And later on, when they have like a big blow up and their friendship is like ending, he says, I don't even, you know, I was lying. Of course, I don't think you're the strongest actor in New York. He's like, there's at least 9 guys better than you. And he lists off 9 guys and ends the list with Griffin Dunn. And Nick Kroll's character protests that he lives too far away. And Mulaney reacts angrily and says, and tells him off, describing exactly how long it takes Griffin Dunn to get to Manhattan. So he counts as one of New York's strongest actors. And that's my main pull for Griffin Dunn. He's great in this movie, which he also produced.
Him and some other lady whose name I can't remember. And
Amy Robinson.
Amy Robinson.
And Robert F. Culsberry, the 3 credited producers. This is, as long as we're on the production side of things, I think this is the last Scorsese feature that isn't a biopic or adaptation.
Oh, Last Temptation of Christ? I don't think that's about anyone, right?
That's about the Temptations?
I think so. Yeah. All right. Yep. Yeah. Bringing Out the Dead? Oh, Bringing Out the Dead must have been like an adaptation of something then.
I guess so. Listen, I just...
Yeah, all right. No, I believe it. I just haven't...
Listen.
I didn't know that. I hadn't thought about that. But yeah, I'm trying to go through his filmography, and most of them are either bios or adaptations.
Yeah. He's been doing a lot of good work with adaptations. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, I don't blame him.
All the Kubrick movies, 2001's kind of in between because they wrote it the same time that the movie was being produced, but whatever. All to say Griffin Dunn's really good in this movie. He's great. He's really perfect as a guy who I don't mean to like, you know, boss baby this, but like Scott Pilgrim in my head as a guy who thinks he's a nice guy, but it can be an asshole at like the flip of a switch and it doesn't take him a lot to get there. I feel like Griffin Dunn does a perfect job being that guy in this movie.
And I will, like, he never loses his temper besides once, which is kind of justified when he is just trying to call his friend in Catherine O'Hara's apartment. And he only has the numbers in his head and he's trying to put it into the phone. And Catherine O'Hara keeps saying random numbers to him and he keeps forgetting what the number is of his friend. And it just drives him crazy.
As a lifelong youngest sibling, that's a bit I've done before too.
I've done it before.
Yeah. It's a good bit and I applaud her efforts.
But I can see how it can be annoying.
Yeah. I mean, it being annoying is the point. I'm just trying to entertain you. I've probably said that too.
You're dead, bud.
That whole sequence is all so good.
Yeah.
And she's got the whistle.
She got the whistle. She's driving a Mr. Softy truck.
Mr. Softy truck that's just prowling the streets for the rest of the night.
And playing the Mr. Softy music. So anytime Paul hears that, he's just like, he's terrified.
You mentioned the suicide earlier for an actual character that we meet and spend some time with. While Paul's running from the Mr. Softy, he witnesses a murder, immediately says, I'll probably get blamed for that too. And then it just runs away. They don't mention it again.
But also one of my favorite jokes in that movie.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's so good.
And I love how casual the murder was too. Like, he looked over first and saw like the couple like in some apartment and like they were just being fine. And then he looks away and then like a second, there's a scream and then there's three shots and one person's dead.
Yeah. And I wonder if it's almost it's like the dreamlike quality or almost like a cartoon logic to a lot of the things that are happening that make it feel less stark, maybe, that there has been multiple deaths in this night and we're still like, oh man, Paul's having a rough one. It's like, no, he's been party to multiple deaths at this point.
A witness, yeah. Cause of, maybe.
Potentially. But yeah, he just wants to go home. I just need to sleep. You have to understand, I need to sleep, or whatever he says to Terry Garr before he leaves.
There was, in that interview with Scorsese and Franz Liebowitz, Scorsese talks about like the scene between
Griffin Newman from Blank Griffin Check.
Newman. Yeah, Griffin Newman from Blank Check.
Griffin Dunn.
Griffin Dunn and John Hurd. And when they're in the cafe or the diner, Scorsese said, like, I need you to be desperate that you want to go home or you need his help. And we're not going to stop filming until you get it right. And his performance in that scene where he's like, please, where are you going? And he grabs his hand and he seems so desperate. It's so good.
It's so good. Yeah. Yeah. He does grab his hand. He's like, I'm going to get your keys.
And I like,
it's fine.
I was in.
Then he immediately sells him out to the mob.
Yes. Probably unintentionally, because he's John Hurt's character is probably like the most normal person that he meets that night.
Yes.
Besides like his little anger outburst on the cash register.
For sure.
Apparently he was supposed to be kind of more crazier. There's a deleted scene that I heard about where it's just a small one, but Paul goes to his apartment and he's like, I'm just going to sleep for a little bit. Or he flips some switch that's near his bed, thinking it's like a light switch. And some like house music starts playing and like strobe lights go off. And it's like, oh, I guess he gets up to some weird stuff at home.
Oh, geez. Of course, Tom, the bartender played by John Hurd, of course, is the boyfriend of Marcy. He gets the call that she's dead as he's about to give Paul some money to take the subway home. And so that shit canned as well.
Yep. Paul also never gets his keys back too from John Hurd.
No, he doesn't.
So John Hurd, I guess, can just come by anytime. Because I imagine there's like a little plastic thing on his keys that I imagine just says like the address.
Yeah, I think that's a situation where once Paul's back at work, he's like, whatever, I'm safe in the light of day. I can call my super landlord and just get the locks replaced and new keys and pay whatever fee that is.
Yeah.
At a certain point, you wrote, I'm going to move on with my life. Those keys are gone.
Yep. Yep. And I'm pretty sure he's happy about that.
Yeah. It was a clean break.
Also, at the very beginning of this movie, in like the epilogue, it's the prologue, I mean, when he's teaching that guy at the computer, is that Christopher Guest?
It looked like a recognizable to me, but I didn't actually fully place him.
Okay. I think he's the guy from who was in Beverly Hills Cop, who works at some art dealership that Eddie Murphy goes to, but I can't remember his name. I always think it's Christopher Guest, but I think it's not him.
The last listed cast member with a name is Bronson Pinchot. I think it's probably him.
Okay. Then I don't even know who that is. I know who, I physically know who he is. All right.
Yeah, here he is. One thing I didn't pick up on until looking at the cast at the end. So that is Bronson Pinchot as Lloyd, it turns out. I don't know if his name's ever said because, you know, Griffin Dunn's not paying attention to that conversation.
Yeah, and I'm not paying attention to it either. I'm looking at paper.
Horst, the whatever man version of Dominatrix is, Dominator, perhaps. I don't know.
I like it.
That Paul comes and interrupts. Is this the guy? Played by Will Patton from the Remember the Titans. He's the white coach.
Oh, okay.
And Minari a few years ago.
Oh, is he the crazy guy?
Yeah.
Oh, well, not the crazy guy, but the
weirdo. Yeah, he's a little bit touched, yeah. But he's... They ultimately let him.
He's a harmless
douse for water.
Yeah, and he's a harmless guy.
Yeah. He's like the only white person that's nice to them.
Yep. Sure, he's a little weird. Huh. Sure, on Sundays it's.
Now that I put those two pulls together, he's often played a white guy that's nice to minorities. Interesting. That doesn't come up in this film.
No, not this film. But you know,
anyway,
he has a streak going.
Yeah. Yeah. As long as we're on cast, mentioned, I think when we weren't recording, Tommy Chong and Cheech Marin hanging out in the background.
Yep. They are the burglars that are actually stealing from all the different apartments in Soho.
Yes.
Except for Kiki's apartment, where they actually just bought something and Paul stops them from taking the stuff that they bought.
I can't believe I didn't see it coming, how that resolves. As it starts happening, I was like, fucking of course. That's how we're getting out of this. And it's perfect. So they left their statue behind because Paul returned it to Kiki thinking that she had been robbed. And she does say that she sold the TV, but then
nothing about the statue.
She says like, oh, what do you mean they had my statue? Or like, oh, how'd you end up with my statue? So I think they actually might have stolen the statue. But although he does
says that he bought it.
Yeah. And then later he says he bought it. So I don't know I don't know who's lying here. Anyway,
Kiki might've just been high. Who knows?
So he gets put into the paper mache to hide from Catherine O'Hara's mob.
And I love the papier-mâché statue that he becomes of this, like, this guy with his hands on his head and he's stuck like that. And like, he's just in a panic state for the rest of his life.
Yes.
His short life that he will have.
The anxious equivalent to the Scream referencing papier-mâché statue that Kiki was making.
Shriek.
Yeah. The Shriek. Yeah. And of course, June's apartment has a direct and easily movable manhole cover to the street level.
One that June does not point out to Paul when he's looking for a way out.
Yes. So funny. Both Paul and Catherine O'Hara ask her if there's any other ways out. And you're like, oh, it's weird they hit that twice, that piece of information. It's like, because of course there was always another way out.
Yep.
And he gets stolen as a statue and then falls out the back of the van. And it's so cool. He stands up, the gates open.
He's at the gates to his work.
Straightens himself out, covered in plaster pants or whatever, and goes back to work.
Yep. I don't know if it's brought up in the interview with Marty and Fran, or if it's brought up in some one other video I watched. But like they pointed out, like he's the last one to leave the office at the beginning of this movie, and then he's the first one back into the office at the end of this movie. And I love the doors of this office too, or at least the gate.
Yeah.
How they almost seem like just heavenly doors. And yes. I mean, especially at the end when
it's like large golden swing, sliding door.
Yeah. And at the end, he's covered in the plaster. So he's just this white figure. So he kind of looks like he's just a ghost going to heaven.
Yeah.
An angel. Yeah.
And then there is the sort of, I don't know. I don't even know what genres are anymore, but the music that's playing at the end is like a big orchestra. Or something,
Mozart or
yeah.
one of those guys.
One of them Mozarts.
Yeah. And I think the last line in this movie is done by Cheech or Chong. I forget which one actually says it. I think it was Cheech. You don't understand art, man. And then I love when he Paul,
the uglier it is, the more expensive it is.
Yes.
Or whatever.
Yep. And then when Paul gets back to his computer at the end of this movie, it just says, "Good morning, Paul." And then it does the whole, like not even 360 view, like this crazy, like wrap around the whole office.
Yeah.
And it's just awesome.
There's a couple times the camera moves like diagonally and zooms in on someone. It's the first time you see Paul. It does that. It does that on Rosanna Arquette later too. I'll be the first person to ever mention this, but that's Scorsese. His cameras move in fun ways.
Oh, you know, I haven't noticed before, but now thinking back, yeah, it does.
He's got some impressive long shots where the camera's moving around a lot and like has a lot of motion and kineticism.
Yeah. And yeah. It's
no one's ever thought that thought before.
I don't think so. And I think it's a good thought you had.
Thank you. I'm being sarcastic, not because that's untrue, but because obviously everyone said that before.
Yeah, because it's one of his staples. And like, he happens to be a really good director.
So good. There is so much of this movie that is dark and like almost sinister, but so much of it just feels like a, I don't know, not exactly like a celebration, but just things are being executed at such a consummate level that it's hard not to get drawn in.
Yeah. Like there, like one shot that I love was just like this really quick, like 2 or 3 seconds of just Rosanne Arquette. She winks at Paul and it's just like a quick zoom on her face. And it's like, oh, this is that rules.
Yeah. What an amazing shot.
Yeah.
It's so good. I enjoyed this film. Anything else we want to say about the movie?
Great stuff.
Great stuff. Great performances. The direction's on point. It's simple, but able to remain surprising to me as it developed, even when things were happening that were coincidences, that were circling back on what happened before, that were tying off loops in really neat ways.
Yeah.
Without being overly obvious to me, or maybe I'm just dumb, but I was consistently surprised and entertained and really, really into this movie.
Yeah. And like, I mean, I could say this about pretty much any Scorsese movie, but like
really go, funny.
Yeah, really funny. I mean, it is really funny.
Yeah.
Like, and I love Scorsese's comedies. Like he did, yeah. Like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore is pretty funny. I mean, Wolf of Wall Street is pretty much a comedy, and that Jesus. Like there's the part where it's Leo's just trying to get to his car is probably like one of the best comedic moments in cinema.
He's fighting with Jonah Hill when he's on the phone when he gets back to his house.
Yep.
It's just so good.
He knows what he's doing. He just watches movies. And like this one, especially considering it's pretty low, like on the radar for a lot of people. Like I didn't really know about this movie until like I decided like I should watch more Scorsese movies.
Yeah, I was going to say, you saying you hadn't watched this until like 2022, but not thought of as one. I mean, even on the wiki, it says it refers to it as a cult film, despite how well liked, even well loved it is now and how highly it's thought of. And it was critically acclaimed at the time, but not one of like the big ones for Scorsese, just in terms of cultural profile, yeah. I guess, but definitely one of my favorites now.
Same. I can't wait to see like how like Todd Phillips poorly puts a movie that is an homage to After Hours.
There's one of the people I follow on Letterboxd said that if I was going to make a Joker origin story that was a ripoff of a Scorsese movie, I would have chose this one instead of King of Comedy. Because you can see why someone like Paul would have turned into the Joker at the end of this time.
Yes, yes, I would have.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get to ratings. On a scale of 0.5 to 5, on any scale of your choosing, what would you give Martin Scorsese's 1985 film After Hours?
I would give it 4.5 signs that point to a dead body.
That's good. There's a lot of stuff in this movie, and
oh, we didn't even bring up the cream cheese everything bagel plaster mold.
I mentioned before.
Oh yeah. Oh, did you?
Yeah, yeah. That was like my biggest laugh is when Terry Garl.
Oh yep, yep, yep. And then I also brought the bagel up the, and cream he cheese. He shoves that out of her hand. Yep.
So that was going to be my scale. Actually, is probably also 4.5 out of 5. Plaster of Paris bagel and cream cheese paperweights out of 5. This movie rocks. I liked it a lot.
Same. I honestly can't wait to watch it again. I'm sure that my 4.5 will probably just be a 5 eventually.
Yeah. For a first time watch, I feel like that's pretty high for me. Because I'm normally in a position where I've watched it before and like I've brought my friends into it. I've got to be like, come on, guys, this one's really good. And so it's nice to not always have to be in that position. Not
I'm
saying
doing
anything.
It to you now.
Yeah.
I bullied you.
And this isn't just because there's two movies now that we've done that I've given a 5-star rating to that Greg's given a 3 or less star rating to. But, you know, whatever.
I mean, it's higher. I mean, he liked it more than Mulholland Drive.
He did like The Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, a perfect movie, a little more than Mulholland Drive, but whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Another perfect movie. Anyway, I never finished my point about The First Omen.
Oh, The First Omen, right?
Yeah, so the First Omen.
Okay.
But not The First Omen, but...
No, The First.
The First Omen. The Omen.
The First The Omen.
And not the remake from the thousands, The Omen.
Oh, that
But
came...
The First The Omen.
Wait, The Omen...
And not The First Omen from 2024.
Okay, not The First Omen that came out on June 6, 2006, right?
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
You watched the first Omen. The first...
No. Yes. Anyway, the point I was going to make...
What a cliffhanger, too. You got to stick... I hope you're still around for this, people.
The original Omen, sorry. We did it a bit longer this time, and it's possible we did do it in the recording already.
Yeah, it's a good bit. I like the bit.
I like the bit, too.
I think we should have done it during After Hours talk.
Yeah, we should have. Instead of just after hours, but before the monthly question, which people need to listen to and they can't leave. They can't go home.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. That's still out there.
It's still out there. It's hanging, but it's fine.
We're like Chad.
Yeah, must be from Florida. Sorry, Al Gore.
Topical stuff here.
The other guy's brother got to decide what I was. I don't remember all the details.
I don't either. I was not old enough. I wasn't voting.
Nine. I wasn't part of it. I can't be blamed. As far as you know. So The Omen in the 1970s that I watched for the first time this last week in preparation to go see The First Omen, which I still want to do because it got good enough reviews. So the point I was going to make after that was about 70s horror because I like a lot of 70s horror movies and I finished watching The Omen. I was like, that was really good. And then I went and looked up some Letterboxd reviews of it. And people were like, yeah, it's pretty good for what it is, but it's nowhere near the other, like, you know, 70s horror classics. It's not, it can't even touch those. And I was like, really? I like this a lot. I had a really good time with it. So then I made a list of 70s horror. Not that I have encyclopedic knowledge of them, but there was at least like 6 or 7 70s horror movies that I've seen. And I did rank The Omen last. And it's just like, The Omen for me was like 4 stars. The rest of these are 4.5 or 5 star movies. It's just an insane murderer's row of movies.
Let's see. Halloween, that's on there, right? The Exorcist. Black Christmas.
Yeah.
So
with the caveat that there's a movie over there you probably think I've seen that I haven't yet because I'm kind of waiting on Don't Look Now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I have to wait. I'm sure no one else in my friend group has seen Don't Look Now, but that's one that I want to see and think I'll have above The Omen.
I don't think I'm going to get the other 3. What do you got? Also, if you want to put it in the order that you rank them, that's I'm fine with that, too. I'll allow it.
This isn't me ignoring you. This is me pulling it out.
Oh, I know. I'm trying to fill the space.
So there's a little bit of genre wackiness maybe here. But, oh, yeah, you know what it actually turns
Carrie.
Out?
Carrie. That's another one.
Yeah. It turns out I have The Omen in front of Black Christmas. But more I think about it, I might have... Black Christmas is a little janky, and The Omen's like Richard Donner is a... at worst a journeyman who can like put together some shit. So the kind of genre fluffy ones you'll notice as we're going, but I have in order Alien.
Okay. Yep. I forgot about Alien.
The Exorcist, Halloween, Jaws.
Oh yeah. That is a horror movie.
Carrie. All of those I have ranked as 5 stars.
Also, I mean like what a murderer's row.
Yes. House.
I would have put House higher on mine, but I also am a big fan of House.
House, which I have as 4.5 stars. Then The Omen and Black Christmas, both of which I have as 4 stars. But yeah, I mean, so those, just for 8 movies, if I took like any other decade, I don't know that they compare with, especially the first 4 there are often considered like, perhaps by a lot of people, the best movie of all time.
Yeah, I mean, one of those is the reason we have summer blockbusters.
Yes. And that one's 4th of those 4. So yeah, the 70s horror, tough club to crack the top.
Yeah. Oh, well, unless you're the Oscars, who you can barely recognize those movies.
Yes. Even though, yeah. I mean, just ask Friedkin, who never gave any respect to the Oscars ever again in his entire life.
Good.
After, because of the fucking controversy and Linda Blair not getting credit because of the lady who did the voice is like, I did everything. She's just some idiot. The Academy was like, her story checks out. Anyway, poor Linda Blair, too.
Yeah. She ended up all right. She got to be in the Exorcist, the beginning.
The one that just came out is Believer?
Oh, that's Believer? The one I meant to bring up.
Yes.
Believer.
And...
That movie sucked so much that I don't care that I got it wrong.
The monthly question. Though this is the 4th episode, I haven't made it any better. What's like a one night situation you could do?
That I could do?
That you think you could handle, you have the skills requisite to do it. It's ranged from I could do an escape from New York, save the president situation, to I could do a super bad let's go to a party situation.
This is not something I necessarily think I can do, but I would like to try and like survive through a night, sort of like After Hours, but also kind of like a Night of Living Dead or something like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of horror that we could have done. I didn't do. I think the most obvious, at least recent series, is The Purge, which by definition is all one night.
I think it's technically it's a day, right? Because it's 24 hours.
Oh.
Right? I think it's a... I never watched any Purge movie, but I think it's a 24-hour period.
That'd be okay.
Purge it's,
there's still technically like one night cycle happening.
Yes, yes.
Because like Escape from New York, Snake's head explodes if he doesn't get this job done within 24 hours. So even though there's a morning that happens in the middle, I'm still counting it as one night only. Also, I forgot that happened.
Yeah.
But we were already doing the episode.
I don't think I could do like Escape from New York thing.
No, I'd be bad at it.
Yeah, I don't think I would get it done. And I'm pretty sure my head would explode.
I'd die before that.
But surviving a night for whatever reason, I think I can do that. I don't know if I... there's a chance I could just die, but it's something I would be interested in doing, I guess.
Yeah.
Also, I know this was brought up in the last episode, but the... I mean, the best and easiest answer is before sunrise. Yes. Meet someone and then have a great night in some European city.
Just walking and talking.
Yep.
God, Aaron Sorkin must love that movie.
He loved it so much, he based his whole career out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he wasn't... Were they walking and talking in A Few Good Men?
There was talking.
There were definitely talking.
There was baseball practice. I don't know if that counts as walking.
I'm not going to count it.
All right, fine.
Disqualified.
Fine. Yeah, that's a good answer, I think. I don't know. There's nothing I can do.
I mean, it's a tough
thing of a good one. But so many of those scenarios are horror.
Yeah.
That it is hard to imagine a horror scenario I survive.
Well, that's why I'm like if I don't have to worry about like dying, or if I die, I'll be fine the next day, or like whatever.
I will say something that I am good at, and maybe this just comes with age, and maybe Paul will get there soon. Not that I'm that old, but I feel like I'm older than Griffin Dunne is supposed to be in this movie, because a lot of the characters play is like late 20s, mid to, I don't know, Rosanna Arquette's like 22 or something, but everyone else I think is supposed to be later 20s.
Yeah.
I'm pretty good at calling in a night.
Yeah, same.
I've gotten way better at that. And I think I, in Paul's situation, leave the loft and go straight home. Even if I have to walk, it's just part of the night now.
It's considering that
I know it's pouring at that point.
Yeah. And considering for Paul, like, this is a work night for him.
It's a work night, and it would be, I mean, we should have mapped it out, but I think it would be a very long walk.
Yeah. And I'm pretty sure on a work night, I would have called it way earlier. If it was like a weekend,
I wouldn't have gone.
I would have stayed around if it wasn't a work night.
Yeah.
Cause sure. I do. One of my favorite time of day is 2 a.m.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing's going on. Everything's asleep. It's awesome. I love that time of day.
Does Lake feel like really hopping around?
No. I mean, yes. There's meth heads around. They're hopping.
Well, hopped up more like. But if I was forced to do this, I would be bad at it too, just from the social anxiety and pervasive awkwardness of every situation he's in. Any place he is intruding, and I hate that feeling when it's happening to me.
I'm pretty sure if I was doing the exact same thing he was doing, like a step by step, I probably would have just killed myself if I went to John Hurd's apartment and then flooded his toilet.
Yeah.
I think I would have just been like, he's going to find this, and I don't want that. I'm already like intruding on his house. I'm just going to end it here.
Yeah. Yeah. That would have put me over the edge.
Yep.
Just like, I don't come back from this one.
And
that's it for me.
John Hurd goes back to his apartment too. So he potentially found that his toilet overflew. I don't think he can blame. I don't think he knows if Paul did it, though. It could have just happened.
It's the 80s, and it's been
Soho.
Yeah. And I was going to say it was raining so hard that maybe there's like a flooding issue that's affecting the plumbing.
Cause
that's the thing that happens.
Cause yeah. I mean, Paul like hits the thing, and like he put a bunch of tissues in there, but they didn't go down at all.
No, like it's not his fault.
Yeah, the water just came up. Just bad luck. Like I said, everything he touches just it's destroyed.
Absolutely. And on that note.
Yeah, on that note.
Let's finish this. Well, Voss, thanks for being on. This is a fun one. It's one probably kind of had circled for a while, theoretically.
Yeah.
Just in a general, like, it's a Scorsese. We'll probably do more Scorsese at some point.
Yeah, Scorsese is always good, and this is definitely one of his movies people should check out more.
Agreed. I had a better time than I was expecting. I thought it would just be anxiety, and that's in there, but it's also funny and weird and surreal in all the kinds of ways that I like.
Same.
So I'm glad I own it, because I definitely am going to watch that again. It is extremely rewatchable. And I'm excited to check out that commentary. All right. Well, again, thanks for being on, Voss. Thanks for listening, listener. And you can find ourselves on Linktree, linktr.ee/late-to-the-movies. Tune in next week for the final episode of One Night Only Month. I think at long last, we're doing Superbad. I say almost every 3 or 4 episodes now that it's really hard to do a comedy and make it interesting. I'm going to put a lot of thought into how to make that one more interesting. Anyway, thanks, Voss.
Thanks for having me.